So hi again. You'll have to bear with me for the second time. It's a different topic, of course, it's back to the 1As. I think I'll take an even more indirect approach than, say, Dan this morning. I'll try and come in similar conclusions, more from the data side, using, in a sense, similar approaches. In some places we do the same thing, in some others we possibly disagree a little bit. But just to give you some background, what I'm going to do is basically try and show you how one can use the observations to derive back the properties of the type 1As. This is at least one thing we have in hand, that's the data. Models can, you know, be quite nice, they'll tell you a lot, but a model is a model, and maybe we can help making those models by telling the people that make them how they should look like. So this is what you can do using radiative transfers, for instance, and that's mostly the topic of this talk. Some relations that we would like to explain, or we think we can explain, we think we understand. This has been discussed before, the relation between the brightness in various bands and the decline rate in those same bands. That's been established years ago, and I think it's a very important thing. What is, in my mind, quite appealing is the fact that when Gertrude Contardo and Bruno try to convert that to bolometric light curves, they seem to get a similar trend where bright is also broad. So that tells you it's partially a wavelength-dependent effect, but this thing is there also in the bolometric light curve. That's quite important. And then this is something that Bruno alluded to the other day. This is an old plot from a paper of mine showing that the bright supernovae, the delta M15 values over here, tend to have broader ion lines than the dim supernovae with a fast decline. Those lines are mostly iron 2 and iron 3. These are spectra taken about a year after the explosion when we think we can see through the ejecta and down to the bottom, basically down to the center. So this is sort of a way to see what went on in the center. And so it was tempting to correlate that with 2 delta M15. This is the old plot that Bruno showed already. There is some sort of correlation there. There will be more about this later because there was community demand for that, so we will have more. A more recent way of looking at these is a bit convoluted perhaps, but this has been shown this morning as well. The decline rate of the velocity of the silicon line as measured in a series of spectra can be used along with other parameters to classify, to divide supernovae into the type 1A supernovae into three groups. Where the red ones here, I mean, we call them by the color that Stefan used at this point, basically represent the faint supernovae, which include 91 BG and similar things, up to 86 G, but not beyond, so delta M15 about 1.5. And then all the rest, from the 91 Ts down to the normal, are divided fairly cleanly into two groups, depending on the rate of change of the silicon velocity over time. So the blue objects here have a large rate of change, and the green objects down here have a smaller rate of change. Now, does that tell us anything? Well, if anything, it tells us about what is going on very early on when the velocities are largest, and then they have to come down to what is a much more common ground later on. So how do we go about trying to understand these things? Well, of course, as we said, we use radiation transfer. This is one sort of model I put there, computed with a Monte Carlo light curve, spectral code of one of the Vega supernovae we observed with this large European program that we've had running for the last 4 or 5 years. And what you can do is, and that's the reason we actually had this program, was that if you can infer properties of the supernova from one spectrum, you hopefully can infer a lot more if you have a series of spectra. We have been doing that in the past, but now we try to do this systematically. And that was basically trying to get as many spectra with close time gaps as possible. So you could see the ejecta as they became, as they become thinner, and as your view sort of gets deeper. So there was an attempt by Matthias Steele, PhD student at MPA, to model this time series of spectra of 2002 BO, which is a fairly normal type 1A. And as you follow the evolution of the spectra, you basically trace the distribution of abundances with depth. which should somehow reflect the properties of the explosion. That's what we think the abundances tell us. Now, that method can only be applied, especially with a code like this, only to about, you know, a few days after maximum, and then your approximations actually fail. But you can actually recover, using the nebula spectra, what goes on in the deepest part of the ejecta. So by bootstrapping the outside and the inside, you can actually get a full picture of what goes on composition-wise at all depths. And what is particularly interesting here is that, as I said earlier, these are iron lines. But because these are seen about 1 year after the explosion, they do come mostly from the nickel 56 that was made at the time of the explosion. Not only that, but these lines come from different ions. This is mostly an iron 3 line. This is mostly a set of iron 2 lines. So by getting the right line ratio, you've got some hope of being able to assess what the densities, temperatures, and so on are, because we are doing ionization balance. So you know all your heating rates, you know your cooling rates, and you're trying to balance those. So you put all that together. This is a plot that I think some version of which Wolfgang showed earlier on, and Fritz as well. Anyway, you have all this complicated spaghetti diagram of composition versus velocity or mass or whichever. And then you compare this to various models. In this case, we have W7 here as an example. Things are fairly OK, except that the iron is mixed out a lot more. You see that here in the observations. The silicon is mixed down much further. So this simple picture is more or less okay, but if you look at the details, it isn't. One has to do a bit more than just taking that one-dimensional model. Maybe three-dimensional models will help, but we are not at this point concerned with that. What we are concerned with is to show that what we've done actually helps reproducing some of the properties. And one of the properties that we try to reproduce is the volumetric light curve. And just to show an example of what happens if you take W7, you get the red curve with the nickel not being mixed out very much. That means the rise is delayed because the photons are trapped in the ejector for longer because they come from deeper, generally speaking. But once you use the abundances derived from the tomography experiment, from the early time spectra, and you place more nickel 56 further out, then you generate gamma rays at higher depths, from the center, so to say. And that makes the light curve rise at earlier times, which reproduces the observations rather nicely without doing anything else to actually tune them. So that was a nice confirmation, at least the method in principle, you know, works fine. So with that in hand, we can try to understand some of the observations. Now, one of the first things that we wanted to do with the RTN program was to take very early spectra, because it has been thought that that's one of the ways to understand what the progenitor actually looked like. Now, I'm afraid that was an effort that, in a sense, didn't quite work, because you probably have to observe very, very early on, and you probably haven't even discovered the supernovae at those times. What we did find by observing about, you know, 1 to 2 weeks before maximum here is, however, something interesting that has been pointed out by other people as well, you know, the Girardi papers, various papers on individual objects. But what we've got here is a collection of every supernova for which we have early time spectrum, very early time spectra of. And that shows that these high velocity things in the calcium and sometimes in the silicon lines are there not just sometimes, but all the time. So the calcium line always starts very, very broad, or even with a double component. Okay? Sometimes the silicon line has bumps, bellies, things that you could interpret as material moving at high velocity, as well as you would for the calcium lines. So does that tell us anything? If it tells us anything, it tells us something about the outer part of the ejector. Okay. One way to make those features, well, this was mentioned earlier this morning, is to have blobs of material. You put a blob there, you observe it under different angles, you get a distribution of material of absorptions at high velocity. So that's an easy exercise to play, to do in 3D, 2D, whatever you like. There's an easy prediction, which is, depending on your viewing angle, the shape of the absorption will change. If your blob is along your line of sight, you'll see a lot of absorption. If you're viewing this from the other side, you will see none. Basically, that's the bottom line. So if you have one blob, does that confirm what we see? Well, what we see, given the small number of objects that we have, is a fairly smooth distribution of covering factors. This is a sort of approximation you can use for a producing spectra. Now, if you only had one blob in there, you would see sometimes a covering factor of close to one, and most times, basically, no covering factor at all, because the blob would be away from your line of sight. So one blob, in that sense, does not explain the fact that every supernova seems to have these high-velocity absorptions. So one has to try other more fancy possibilities. That is, multiple blobs, for instance, or tori. And this is a work that mostly was done by Masaomi Tanaka at the University of Tokyo, using a 3D version of the same Monte Carlo code that was shown earlier. And he was trying to basically reproduce what is the observed distribution, which is fairly flat, using various combinations of either blobs or size tori. And the result that he gets, which I think quite interesting, is that, well, we said one blob is not enough. Too many blobs is also not good, because you end up with a large covering factor all the time. But a few well-placed blobs do the trick. Regardless of the viewing angle, you always see some degree of high-velocity absorption. So is this what the outer part of the explosion looks like? Well, in our eyes, from the spectra, that must be it. How you can produce this from the explosion point of view is a different story, which I will not try to address, but I think that's an indication that either that configuration or a fairly thick torus, and how you produce that I also do not know, will give you the observed distribution of line profiles. And if you use either of those two distributions by just changing the viewing angle, you get basically all the observed line shapes at about, you know, minus 10 days, roughly. So this is for the outside. Let's now switch to what we can learn about the whole thing by looking at both the outside and the inside. So there was a request for this earlier on, and this is a new version of the velocity of nebular lines versus decline rate relation, now based on more objects with better observations, multiple observations as well, so you can see whether there is any change of the line velocity with time and stuff like that. The relation, I think, remains, it's actually, you know, not that tight, but it's clear, I think, with the least luminous objects showing the narrowest lines. That's very easy, I think, to understand. There is more iron in the brighter objects, and because you place this in some sort of density, you're going to have a bigger volume taken up by nickel 56, and so your nebular lines will be broader. The next plot is a bit more complicated to understand. Here we're trying to, this is still just fitting the nebular lines with a nebular spectrum model. And we're now plotting the nickel 56 mass versus decline rate. And what we see here is that there is a fairly good relation, except that perhaps the blue objects, which are the ones with a fast light curve decline, are more spread. They're less predictable, in a sense. But the majority of the objects fall along a fairly narrow strip in this diagram, suggesting that the nickel 56 mass and the rate of decline are actually related. This is not new. Another question to ask ourselves, we heard Ken talk about this earlier, is what is the role of the stable nuclear statistical equilibrium elements, nickel 58, iron 54 in particular? We can do that by looking at the late time spectra, because these elements, especially the iron, radiate, so they cool the gas, but they do not heat the gas, because they do not come from nickel 56. They were formed like that, so they stayed like that. So in order to get your ionization correct, you've got to put in the right amount of these stable elements. And if you try and plot radioactive versus stable here, you find something that is almost like a scatter diagram. There is some degree of correlation of the green objects, which indicates, you know, almost an anti-correlation, less nickel 56, more stable stuff. But all in all, there is nothing clear going on. What gets interesting, though, is the next plot, where we try to add the radioactive and the stable iron group elements together and plotted those against decline rate. Now, that gives rise to a nice relation, which is actually tighter, significantly tighter than the relation between nickel 56 only and decline rate. So how do we take this? At face value, this tells us that the correlation between the NSC material and the B-band light curve is so tight that the NSC must be responsible, even more than just nickel 56, for the decline rate. NSC, of course, these are the elements that contribute mostly to the line opacity, as we heard from Dan this morning. So that's where the iron lines are made and so on. So it's perhaps not unexpected that this is the behavior. But it is actually nice to see borne out by modeling. So then you have to patch the inside and the outside together. So this view of the nebula spectra gives us the inside, the view of the silicon velocities gives us a view of the outside. The first thing to say is, well, is there a relation between the outer silicon velocity, iron velocity, and the inner silicon velocity? We heard the comment this morning, I can't remember by whom, that there does not seem to be a relation. Well, actually, the answer is there is a very good relation. The dim objects have very low terminal silicon velocities. They agree very well with the low iron velocities. And the bright objects have much higher silicon velocities. Below those, everything is iron, nickel, cobalt. So there's a good relation between the innermost silicon velocity and the luminosity of the supernova, which is, again, I think, not unexpected. What is maybe unexpected, though, is the fact that the outer silicon velocity, at least for the green and the red objects, is about constant. So all the objects seem to come out with a higher velocity that is about the same. What does that tell us? It tells us, as we heard earlier, that the energy produced in the explosion, if we assume that these are all Chandrasekhar mass white dwarfs, the energy produced in the explosion must be fairly similar because a similar amount of mass must have been burned. There will be differences because burning to silicon makes a bit less energy than burning to nickel 56 or stable NC elements. But by and large, the energies must be similar as long as the masses are thought to be, are assumed to be similar. And if you use the standard, and this is of course an approximation because the energy may not be exactly the same, if you use the standard W7 model to convert between velocity and mass, you find out that most supernovae will have burnt about between 1 and 1.2 solar masses of the white dwarf upon exploding. So you can finally build what I call the Zorro diagram here, although the Z is sort of inverted, but I like that. You start placing the stable NSC material, which is located mostly in the center. And that's a floor of about 0.2 solar masses, fairly constant, independent of decline rate. Okay. Then you add the nickel 56, which gives you the spread, brighter objects, more nickel, but it's not a very tight relation. And there's objects for which we derive fairly different nickel 56 masses, but which have nominally the same decline rate. Once you sum the stable and the radioactive NSC material together, you find this tighter relation. And now the dispersion between values, between supernovae at the same decline rate bin is actually less, indicating again that it's the amount of NSC that drives the shape of the light curve. And then you add the silicon, and what you find is that there is basically an inverse relation. The more nickel 56 and stable iron you make, the less intermediate mass elements you're going to burn. So somehow, the supernovae sort of know how much to burn. This is the answer, the result of this investigation. Now, the most plausible way, as Fritz sort of hinted at this morning, to achieve this and to burn a whole star is for the mode of explosion to start as a deflagration as it must, but to continue at some point as a detonation, because only that way will you actually manage to burn most of the star. I think a typical deflagration will have this line more or less inclined like that. And this is not apparently what we see. And these are just the names of the objects. And so just to recap, I said all this. The assumptions we've used are outlined here. Nickel 56 makes a light, the stable stuff only makes opacity, the intermediate mass elements give you kinetic energy and some opacity, the CO, if there is any, contributes very little only to the opacity. And you can use that to generate something that looks like a Phillips relation by changing the amount of nickel 56 and therefore the total amount of opacity by leaving the floor unchanged. This is old work, but it more or less gives you in the bolometric approach a reasonable reproduction of what we see. And this is just to recap the equations we use. Some of these are well established, like Arnett's approach to the light curve, like the kinetic energy production from Stan's paper. Others are a bit more hand-waving, like Max Riefenger's definition of luminosity and nickel mass, and my own definition for the opacity, which is based on the number of active lines in a mixture. But once you plug those equations in and use the values that we got from our investigation and build synthetic light curve properties, you find, first of all, a good relation between decline rate and the observed decline rate. And then finally, and I think I'll close on this because I'm out of time, you can reconstruct from the observational data the width of the volumetric light curves from mostly the Contardo paper. And put our supernovae on that plot, luminosity from the Nickel 56 as estimated from the nebula spectra, light curve width as estimated from building those toy light curves, and compare that to the trend from the Contardo relation, and those are very, very close to one another, actually. They're too close. So I think I'll end at this point because I think I'm out of time. I'll take questions. Thanks.
Questions?
Alex.
Yeah, Paolo, that's very interesting. What I wanted to ask about was what you think about these subchandra suggestions. I mean, you're using essentially a chandra mass here, and Bruno presented evidence on Monday that many of them, or some of them, might be considerably subchandra. If so, what are you doing about that? And if not, what's going on? What's going wrong with his analysis?
Well, just, I came from a background of thinking that the faint objects were themselves subchandra. The thing that makes me now go to the other side is that to see the silicon velocity start very high and decline over about a similar time to very low velocities indicates there is enough material at all depths, at all velocities, to absorb and make a strong silicon line. And if you want to have that, you have to have enough mass to achieve that. And you can only do that if there is about, one chandra second mass of material there anyway. As for what Bruno showed the other day, I think the point is that that analysis, in my opinion, is sensitive mostly to material that is optically, that influences the opacity. And the NSC material does that much more than the intermediate mass elements. So that kind of analysis does not intrinsically see the low opacity material. And so I think that if we plotted my NSC line versus Max's total masses, those two lines would actually agree fairly nicely.
Well, so in some private discussions, we've discussed that, but if the opacity is mostly electron scattering opacity, but it's not, you're saying?
The opacity is mostly line opacity.
Okay, in these type 1As.
This goes back to
I don't know, maybe Bruno wants to comment on that, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think this is a fairly well established fact. I mean, the electron scattering opacity is quite low.
I think I just wasn't listening at the right moment. How do you derive the stable iron?
From the ratio of iron 2 to iron 3 lines in the nebula phase. You have to set your ionization correct. And iron made from nickel gives you heating and cooling at the same time. Iron that was made as iron only cools the gas. And so you can use that to tune your line ratio. And you derive that way how much stable stuff there is.
All right. As a brief follow-up, are the supernova telling you that those relationships between the stable and unstable are there, or is it just already in your synthetic models?
Well, the supernovae are just giving us data. The best we can do is try and model those data using the physics that we know of. and that's what we get from modeling. Of course, there's no direct signature of the 54 versus 56.
And going back to the Zorro plot,
you want to back up?
I think what you presented here is a nice self-consistent picture to reaffirm many things we think. But I think I would fit that plot with three rectangles that go down. What?
So you think there's a big spread over here, and then there are some that do this and some that do that. This may well be.
Yeah.
This may well be. What is interesting is that in this central region, it's not as obvious to predict what the nickel 56 mass actually is. This may tell you something about what the light curve, what the measurements of the light curve do for you because of the mixing out of the nickel 56, which may not be the same in all objects. So the time of maximum is actually quite an important parameter in that sense. And this is something that should be folded into analysis that I didn't do. I mean, if I just take L equals constant times nickel mass, I assume a constant time of maximum, and that should be corrected for. And different nickel distributions will give you different rise times.
So observationally, getting the 91 BG lights would really, and if you get a whole another 50 and they don't fall in the middle there or something, that's at least telling you something pretty clear that something's basically right there.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll get on that.
Yeah. But get the late time spectra as well, because for a lot of interesting objects, we don't have late time spectra.
How late?
Well, like a year.
Okay.
So like, you know, we've got 2000 CX in here, but we don't have 02 CX.
Yeah, Paulo, there's two questions I have. I still haven't understood how you get the silicon inner boundary and the outer boundary.
You just look at the spectra and follow them for as long as you can and see where the silicon is absorbed. The velocity of the absorption declines with time, but the texture of silicon is there. And that's how you set your inner boundary. Okay. As for the outer value, there are various things you could do. You could take the highest value of the absorption, taking the earliest spectrum. Unfortunately, we don't have a homogeneous set of data where we can do that. So the best thing you can do is extrapolate backwards the behavior at around maximum, and that way we think we set a lower limit for where the silicon is. There is silicon absorption above that, but that does not mean that the silicon is 100% of the composition. All right? But we're saying there is at least silicon up to that point. So it may well be that all the rest of the star is also burned. But that tells us at least.
I guess that's my other question. I mean, if you look at this diagram, all your supernovae have about 0.3 to 0.4 solar masses of unburned.
But that's a result of doing that.
So, sorry, what's the magic about that number now? Why is you have all these different explosions, and in the end, all those different explosions end up with about the same mass of unburned material?
As I said, the only way that we can easily think of explaining this is to say that at some point the detonation sets in and burns most of the rest of the star.
Well, I just wanted to come back to this question about the iron peak elements that are not radioactive and that you've modeled with this ratio of iron 2 to iron 3. And what would be really nice would be a way to validate the model and to see whether there was some other thing that's predicted that we could look for. And I was wondering whether you thought about that. It seemed to me that it might be that some of these infrared lines that we were talking about earlier today would be less sensitive to some of these problems, and that you should make a prediction for that, that we could go out and look.
Quite possibly, yeah.
And next we'll have